Justice Department official told prosecutors that the U.S. should just sink suspected drug vessels at sea. That was 6 months before strikes began in the Caribbean.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us with exclusive reporting.
It's Monday, November 17th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour to Chicago, which has been the site of immigration enforcement operations.
Department of Justice records show that more than 600 arrests may have violated a federal consent decree.
You look at this list, and it is very clear that they just did a broad sweep of anybody.
Later to Maine, where a network of health clinics is fighting for its survival.
A provision in the Republican budget law would cut it out of Medicaid because it provides abortions.
Not being able to be reimbursed for the visits it's really crippling financially.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump is now telling House Republicans they should vote to release the Epstein files, NPR's Sage Miller reports.
Trump took to Truth Social to say even though he considers it a Democratic hoax, Republicans should vote to release the files because there's nothing to hide. The House is set to vote on the petition this week. There is a possibility that dozens of Republicans vote in favor to release the files collected during an investigation by the Department of Justice. The administration has released thousands of private files to the House Oversight Committee, but the Justice Department still has documents that have not been made public, including witness interviews. If the measure passes the House, it would still need to be approved by the Senate and signed by the president. Sage Miller, NPR News.
Saudi Arabia's crown prince is heading to Washington for a meeting at the White House tomorrow with President Trump. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports the meeting's agenda is expected to cover a lot of ground, from investment deals to a U.S. defense pact.
The last time Prince Mohammed bin Salman visited Washington was 7 years ago, just before his aides killed Saudi critic and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, sparking international outcry. But the heir to the Saudi throne returns to Washington as a partner, not a pariah. The prince, known also for major social and economic reforms that have changed life in Saudi Arabia, has vowed hundreds of billions of dollars in investments in the U.S. under Trump. He's expected to ask for F-35 fighter jets, advanced AI chips, nuclear technology, and a defense pact that wouldn't require congressional approval. Underpinning those talks are personal ties between Trump and Prince Mohammed. That was on display in May when the president chose Saudi Arabia again as his first overseas trip. And those personal ties mix with business as billions from the Gulf flow into Trump's family ventures. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A new analysis finds the Trump administration's cuts to National Institutes of Health grants affected hundreds of clinical trials and thousands of patients. NPR's Rob Stein reports on the findings published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine.
Since returning to office, the Trump administration has terminated hundreds of grants from the NIH for medical research. Researchers at Harvard analyzed clinical trials funded by the NIH between the end of February and the middle of August. They found 383 clinical trials involving at least 74,000 participants were affected. Studies involving infectious diseases, heart disease, and respiratory diseases were hit hardest. One out of every 37 NIH cancer trials was affected. Rob Stein, NPR News.
A new analysis shows that more people are falling behind on their utility bills. Past due balances jumped 9.7% in the second quarter over the same period last year, according to the Century Foundation, a left-leaning think tank. The foundation says nearly 6 million households have utility debt so severe that it'll soon be reported to collection agencies. This is NPR News from Washington. Bangladesh's ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has been sentenced to death for her role in a deadly crackdown on a student uprising last year. The International Crimes Tribunal in Dhaka passed the sentence today. Hasina fled to India after the uprising and was sentenced in absentia. India has declined to extradite her. The uprising began over a controversial jobs quota system and resulted in more than 800 deaths. South Korea has proposed holding military-to-military talks with North Korea for the first time in 7 years. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that the immediate goal is to prevent military clashes along the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, dividing the two Koreas.
South Korea says North Korean troops have crossed the military demarcation line, or MDL, at the center of the DMZ more than 10 times this year, while building roads and fences and laying mines, sometimes forcing the South to fire warning shots. The MDL was marked with signposts at the end of the Korean War, but that was more than 70 years ago, and most of the signs are now illegible, disintegrated, or covered by vegetation. Seoul says the bigger goal of the talks is to lower tensions and restore trust between the two Koreas. But North Korea has ignored the South's efforts at outreach, cut all channels of communication, and abandoned its goal of eventual reunification with the South. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
AAA is projecting that 81.8 million people will travel at least 50 miles from home over the Thanksgiving holiday. That's an additional 1.6 million travelers compared to last Thanksgiving, potentially a new overall record. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Looking at weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the mid-teens, low 20s. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the low to mid-40s, overnight lows in the mid to upper 20s. And Wednesday, cloudy, highs near 40 to 42.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. For more than 2 months now, the Trump administration has been blowing up suspected drug boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Ocean. The goal, they say, is to stop the flow of illicit drugs into the U.S., but these military strikes are a huge change from what the U.S. had done for decades, which was intercepting such boats at sea, seizing the drugs, and prosecuting the crew. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here in the studio with exclusive reporting on this change and what it means. Hi.
Hi there.
So, Ryan, you've got a story out today about these deadly strikes on suspected drug boats. And I read it earlier, and it starts with you taking readers behind closed doors to this Justice Department meeting in February. Tell us what happened.
Right. There was a conference in South Carolina for the Justice Department's top transnational crime and drug prosecutors, including the people who focus on maritime interdiction, so stopping drug shipments at sea. And what those interdictions traditionally look like is the Coast Guard will intercept a boat, seize the drugs, bring the crew to the U.S. to face prosecution. Well, at this conference, the then-acting Deputy Attorney General, Emil Bove, told prosecutors that the Trump administration wasn't interested in doing those interdictions anymore. And then he said that the U.S. should, quote, just sink the boats. Mm. That's according to three people who were in the audience. They all spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution. One of them said jaws dropped when Bove said this. They said they understood Bove to mean that the U.S. was just going to blow the boats up, kill the people on board. Two other attendees said that it wasn't clear to them at the time what Bove meant, in part because it just seemed an outlandish idea, but looking back on it now, they view it differently. One of them said, in retrospect, it seems Bove really did mean to just sink the boats with the people on them.
Now, Ryan, this happened back in February, which was 6 months before the Trump administration began blowing up suspected drug boats, right?
That's correct. We knew in February that the administration wanted to go after drug cartels, but nobody was talking publicly back then about military strikes like we've seen in the past few months. And that's why Bove's comments here are so striking. They certainly suggest that there were discussions among top administration officials very early on about the deadly strikes that have now become the norm. Now, Bove left the Justice Department after being confirmed as a federal appeals court judge in late July. I reached out to him for the story, and through a court representative, he declined to comment.
Okay. Now, you spoke to a number of current and former officials about the Trump administration shift to do these deadly strikes. What did they have to say?
Right. So I spoke with nine current and former officials for this story. They are all people who spent much of their careers focused on transnational criminal organizations and drug trafficking. So they have a lot of experience. They are not fans of drug cartels. They all questioned the legality of the Trump administration's military strikes. Many of them refer to the strikes as murder, and they point out that there's no due process here for the folks who are being killed. Now, the Trump administration, for its part, disagrees. It says these strikes are lawful and that the president is acting under his Article II powers as commander-in-chief and in self-defense. The Justice Department said in a statement that the administration is committed to ending drug trafficking and said that these leaks are from disgruntled employees. Now, there's also a firm belief, I have to say, among the people who I spoke with, that the new Trump administration policy is not going to be any more effective than interdicting the boats has been. And this new policy may actually be counterproductive.
Counterproductive how?
So the current and former officials I spoke with said that interdictions are crucial to gaining information about drug cartels. One former FBI official told me they used to call it a self-licking ice cream cone. And what he meant by that is the U.S. stops a boat, seizes the drugs, arrests the crew, then uses the leverage of potential prison time in the U.S. to get a crew member to cooperate. That cooperator gives information that helps the U.S. intercept more drug boats, get more informants, and learn more about the cartels and their operations. As one former senior Justice Department official told me, if the U.S. is killing all of these people on the boats, you can't talk to them. So over time, the U.S. government's intelligence on the cartels, on their operations, is going to run dry, and that's going to make it harder to fight these drug cartels.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Right now, a network of medical clinics that provide abortion in Maine are staring down deep funding shortfalls because of a new federal law that cuts them out of Medicaid. This is in a state where, according to a recent report from the Pew Research Center, nearly 3 in 4 residents think abortion access should be legal in all or most circumstances. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has this report from Maine.
It was winter 2020, the first COVID winter in Oxford, Maine. Ashley Smith got a phone call from an ex-partner.
Somebody that I haven't spoken to in a couple months is like, ooh, hey, I hate to reach out and tell you this, but...
They'd tested positive for a sexually transmitted infection called chlamydia.
I just quickly did a Google search to see who was going to be in the area that I could just schedule an STI test. And that Google search led me to Maine Family Planning in Norway.
Which was very close by, and they got her in quickly. Smith works in restaurants as a server. She doesn't have health insurance, so she came ready to pay cash. But the test was free.
They made that process so easy and, like, so painless.
From then on, that's where Smith went when she needed a doctor. Maine Family Planning has been around a long time, 50 years. They have 18 clinics all over the rural state, so there was still one nearby when she moved. She's gone there for pap smears, breast exams. She once went to get a physical to work at a summer camp.
I was like, I know that you guys offer primary care. Can you basically just take my weight and tell them that my blood pressure is okay?
She says most importantly, they diagnosed a chronic condition for her, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. She says getting that treated has improved her quality of life dramatically.
It's night and day who I am.
Clearly, she is a fan of Maine Family Planning, so much so that the 36-year-old has turned into an advocate. In March, she fought off nerves to testify in the state legislature at a committee hearing.
I'm here because these nonprofit clinics are my only source of health care.
The need for advocacy is because of recent actions by the federal government, and because in addition to cancer screenings and STI testing and all the rest, Maine Family Planning provides abortion care. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade 3 years ago, 12 states banned abortion outright and more passed severe restrictions. States like Maine have moved in the other direction to expand access. Now, the Republican-led federal government is moving to restrict abortion access in states where it's legal and protected, using federal funding as its lever.
Hey, come on in.
To be specific, Medicaid funding is now unavailable to Maine Family Planning clinics for any services. Vanessa Shields-Haas is the nurse practitioner at the clinic in Thomaston, Maine, a small town along the coast.
This is our larger exam room. Here we do most of our yearly wellness visits. We do vulvar biopsies and vasectomies. And intrauterine inseminations as well for people.
Just like Ashley Smith, who needed a basic physical for her summer camp job, many of her reproductive health patients come in needing primary care, too. 70% of Maine Family Planning patients only see them as their doctor.
I can treat your tick bite or your bronchitis. I tell people if you cut your finger off or you're having a heart attack, I'm going to send you to the emergency room. But there's a lot of many other things that can be treated here. And
clinics like this one were already prohibited from getting Medicaid reimbursement for abortion because of the Hyde Amendment, which passed in the 1970s. What's new now is a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act the congressional Republicans passed this summer, which blocks several healthcare organizations, including Planned Parenthood and Maine Family Planning, from receiving any Medicaid funding for any services for 1 year.
So since July 4th, since the bill was passed, we haven't been reimbursed for visits for patients who use Medicaid as their insurance. And
we've been seeing all of those patients for free. We haven't been turning them away.
A lot of her patients do seasonal jobs. Half of Maine Family Planning's patients are on Medicaid.
Maybe they're working at a hotel, or they're waiting tables, they're serving lobster rolls to hungry tourists, starting oyster farms. These are entrepreneurs. These are people that are working really hard.
Shields Haas tries to be there for them for whatever they need. She's acutely aware that there aren't enough doctors in this rural state. She calls the new law infuriating.
Unfortunately, decision makers in Washington are having such a profound impact on what we can and can't do. Not being able to be reimbursed for the visits is, it's really crippling financially.
The person tasked with troubleshooting that problem is George Hill, Maine Family Planning's president and CEO. He works about an hour's drive away at the organization's headquarters in Augusta.
I've been in the field since 1987, so close to 40 years.
Over those years, many presidential administrations have been hostile to their work, he says.
This is, by volume and velocity, probably the worst that we have seen.
Maine Family Planning filed a lawsuit to challenge the law that blocks them from getting Medicaid funding. In its response to the suit, the federal government said the provision furthers Congress's, quote, goal of reducing abortion, and suggested Maine Family Planning could stop providing abortions to get its funding back. For now, while that lawsuit works its way through the courts, Maine Family Planning cannot receive Medicaid funding. That's $2 million, 20% of their budget, gone.
That's difficult. You have to make some difficult decisions. Either you generate more money, more revenue, or you cut costs.
In the short term, they've had to cut some services. On November 1st, Maine Family Planning ended primary care services at three clinics in the far reaches of the state. Staff helped nearly 1,000 patients find new doctors. Hill hopes that decision will help preserve the rest of what they do.
We have a mission, and our mission is to make sure that access to sexual and reproductive health care, the full range of sexual and reproductive health care, is available to as many patients as possible.
They also received some additional funding from the state to help fill the gap. And he says they're exploring new ways to raise revenue. He quotes the late Democratic lawmaker, Pat Schroeder.
You can't roll up your sleeves and get to work if you're wringing your hands. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. We're not going to stop.
Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Augusta, Maine.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivy, exploring the distinctly American art form. And tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer host at Jazz on America Avenue. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer here on KAXE KBXE.
On today's date, November 17th, 1987, red-winged blackbirds, flock of them, about a dozen birds, are still hanging around Prairie Lake. And I'm not sure quite why, but they are managing somehow to find enough food to keep themselves alive and active. I suspect that they will be heading south anytime soon. There are seldom any records of red-winged blackbirds in northern Minnesota over the winter. Perhaps one or two, but never more than that. And they typically return with the robins about the mid to late March, when the temperature starts climbing back above 37 degrees for an average each day. That's when we would expect to see the red-winged blackbirds back in our area. Why this group has stayed so long, I don't know. They aren't confiding in me, but nonetheless, here they are, and it certainly set a record for a late observation of red-winged blackbirds.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. What are Benjamin Netanyahu's next moves? Now that a ceasefire has been declared in Gaza, the Israeli prime minister faces challenges at home, but is planning to run for re-election. President Trump is coming to his aid, as NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
When Israel and Hamas reached a ceasefire, President Trump addressed the Israeli parliament, heaping praise on, quote, a man of exceptional courage.
You know who I'm talking about. There's only one, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Baby, please stand up.
Netanyahu overruled his far-right political partners and accepted Trump's ceasefire deal.
I want to tell you, he's not the easiest guy to deal with, but that's what makes him great. That's what makes him great.
It was Netanyahu's last day to shine in parliament before the daggers came out. Tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jewish men protested in the streets against a law that would require them to serve in the military. Their leaders are key to Netanyahu's ability to stay in power, but they won't support Netanyahu's coalition if their community is made to serve in uniform. The Gaza war changed everything. The military says it needs more soldiers.
Don't forget that in the Israeli society, the army is something that is very important to us.
Bini Ashkenazi is a political correspondent for the conservative Israeli newspaper Israel Hayom.
When we are speaking about the army, when we are speaking about the ultra-Orthodox issue that they are not serving, most of the people are not accepting that.
Another big challenge Netanyahu faces is Israelis' fury over Hamas's October 7th attack in 2023. Ruby Chen spoke at the funeral of his son. His body was held hostage in Gaza and recently returned. He said he would not stop pursuing the country's leaders over the October 7th security failure till they offer answers under oath in a national commission of inquiry. Netanyahu opposes such a committee investigating him. In parliament this week, he said it would be politically biased against him. A large part of the country won't trust the members of the committee, he said. Some Israeli analysts think all the domestic pressures Netanyahu faces could cause his coalition to collapse in a matter of weeks or months. Former Netanyahu political advisor Nadav Strauchler says the prime minister is already in election campaign mode.
I think that Trump's words in the parliament, in the Knesset, was the starting of Netanyahu's campaign. And when you go to a campaign with Trump on your right side, it's a very sweet spot for Netanyahu to work from.
If elections were held today, polls show Netanyahu would not win a majority for his camp. Neither would anyone else. The opposition is splintered. Elections could end in a stalemate. And the way Israel's system works, Netanyahu could still hang on, says Strauchler.
A draw means a win for him. So he doesn't have to win. He just needs not to lose next election in order to stay in power.
Trump is already intervening to try to save Netanyahu from his legal troubles. Netanyahu is on trial for alleged corruption. When Trump addressed the parliament last month, he turned to Israel's president.
Hey, I have an idea. Mr. President, why don't you give him a pardon?
On Wednesday, Israel's president received a letter from Trump asking him to do just that. Netanyahu's corruption trial drags on into its sixth year. All the while, he remains in office. Repeatedly, he's gotten the judges to delay his trial, the latest reason being that Trump's envoy was in town. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Where might we look for inspiration for new cancer therapies? Some researchers say perhaps the bowhead whale. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
So there's this paradox in cancer biology. Large, long-lived animals have lots of cells, which in theory should mean more chances to develop cancer.
But that's not what happens.
Vera Gorbunova is a biologist at the University of Rochester.
It suggests that these large and longer-lived animals have additional protections from cancer that they evolved.
Take elephants. They have 20 copies of a key tumor suppressor gene. Humans have just one. This gene produces a protein called P53 that helps eliminate cells that turn precancerous.
P53 protein can trigger cell death. Cells would commit suicide.
With more copies of this gene, elephants may eliminate more potentially problematic cells and keep their cancer rates down.
We took it to another extreme. We decided, what if we look at whales that are even larger than elephant?
Specifically, the bowhead whale. It's not the largest whale, but it is the longest lived, with animals capable of surpassing 200 years of age, something the Alaskan Inuit have known for generations.
They use their traditional methods like rowboats to harvest a very small number of whales every year. So they very kindly agreed to share very small pieces with us so we could do our research.
Research that Gorbunova says might benefit the Inuit someday, a community grappling with growing cancer rates. So with fresh bowhead tissue in hand, she and her team began their experiments. She figured that since bowheads are bigger than elephants, maybe they just had even more copies of that tumor suppressor gene.
But that's not what we found. So the next step was to think, what else can they do to avoid cancer?
Perhaps, she thought, bowheads are better at repairing DNA, since breaks in DNA can be dangerous and lead to cancer. Sure enough, the bowhead cells were far better at it than human cells.
They were not losing pieces of DNA. They were fusing the ends correctly.
An ability due, at least in part, to a different protein that's way more abundant in bowhead cells and which is produced by a gene activated by the cold. When the researchers made human cells overproduce the protein, those cells repaired DNA breaks more efficiently. And when they caused live fruit flies to make a lot of the protein,
they started living longer, and they also became more resistant to DNA damage.
Gorbunova says boosting the level of this protein in humans might one day help slow down our accumulation of mutations.
The most important take-home message for us humans is that there is room for improvement.
The findings appear in the journal Nature. Amy Boddy is an evolutionary biologist at UC Santa Barbara who wasn't involved in the research. She studies elephants, among other species, and says drawing connections between human health and long-lived animals that may be vulnerable to extinction can pack a powerful conservation message.
Maybe we should protect against poaching because they are these amazing, magical creatures that can maybe one day help human health.
And these results may be just the beginning. Vincent Lynch, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Buffalo who didn't participate in the study, says animals like the bowhead have likely evolved additional ways to keep cancer at bay.
We have literally uncovered a handful of the mechanisms that are responsible for their cancer resistance. There's going to be a whole lot more to identify.
This may well be the power of looking beyond typical short-lived lab animals like mice and flies, says Vera Gorbunova. Whales and elephants appear to have much to teach us from their many years on this planet. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is National Native News. Programming on KXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org /grants. And we received support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native American woman and her family are thankful that she's not detained and potentially deported by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has the story.
On Veterans Day, 24-year-old Letitia Jacobo completed a short sentence at the Polk County Jail in Des Moines, Iowa, for a traffic infraction. She was supposed to have been released at midnight, but things took an odd turn.
I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to put it in words. It was shocking. I was like, how do I have an ICE hold and I'm Native American? It was just weird. It was just crazy.
Jacobo's mom, Erica Burns, learned that her daughter was placed under an ICE detainer and was worried. Both women are members of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community and therefore legal U.S. citizens. Jacobo's aunt, Maria Nunez, said her sister sprung into action.
Being the holiday that day, we couldn't do much. And here on her reservation side of the family was jumped on the media and reached out to everyone and whoever we could, because we didn't want her removed and sent to we don't know where.
Nunez says the tribal police chief called into corrections officials to vouch for Jacobo's citizenship. And an investigator learned that another inmate at the jail had the same last name as Jacobo. A spokesman for the Polk County Sheriff's Office said it was all a clerical mix-up, and staff have been talked to about preventing repeat errors. Again, Letitia Jacobo.
I'm very thankful for having family members and people out here, because if I didn't, who knows what would have happened. I would have just unknowingly went to ICE custody. So it would have been a scary moment.
Many Native people and supporters are calling this a case of racial profiling, and Jacobo is weighing a lawsuit. For now, though, she plans to celebrate the holiday season with her family. Maria Nunez says she's happy that her niece is safe.
I'm just so proud to be Native American and have all the love and support and knowing that we're all ready to fight and protect what's ours.
Since the Trump administration ramped up its immigration crackdown, tribes have complained of ICE confronting their enrolled citizens. Many have issued guidance on their rights and what documentation to present if detained. Neither the Des Moines ICE office nor the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community returned requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Colorado River has long been considered a lifeline for the Southwest. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, one Arizona tribe is now acknowledging the waterway as having the same rights and legal protections as tribal members.
The Colorado River Indian Tribes, or CRIT, would not say whether it was unanimous, but the 9 council members still voted to recognize personhood for the namesake river under tribal law. It comes at a pivotal time when sustained drought threatens this natural resource CRIT considers a living entity, running parallel to the tribe's nearly 300,000-acre reservation along the California border. This measure also tasked tribal councils to take the Colorado River's needs under consideration amid an uncertain future on 2 fronts, climate change and ongoing water negotiations. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in Seattle for the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention and Marketplace. Leaders are tackling top issues facing their communities, from economic development, education, climate, to language and culture. Additionally, a youth convention is taking place. Both gatherings continue through Friday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver-resources. Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Over the weekend in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Department of Homeland Security launched its latest enforcement action targeting undocumented immigrants. DHS calls it Operation Charlotte's Web and says it's going after violent criminal immigrants. This is similar to a crackdown that DHS launched in Chicago in September. However, a recent court filing there shows that hundreds of immigrants arrested in Chicago have no criminal record. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has been following this and joins us now. Hi.
Hey, Juana.
Sergio, tell us about this court filing in Chicago and its connection to this operation that DHS is calling Operation Midway Blitz.
Yeah, so the Department of Justice late last week submitted a list that contained the names of 614 immigrants arrested recently in Chicago. These are arrests, a federal judge says, may have violated a 2022 federal consent decree. So this is part of an ongoing legal case. Now, that settlement puts strong conditions on making arrests without warrants or probable cause. The attorneys for these people say their clients were simply swept up in Operation Midway Blitz. This means they are eligible to be temporarily released either on bond or with an ankle monitor or any other monitoring device while their cases continue.
Now, the Trump administration says that the surge of federal agents in Chicago has had an impact, that it's decreased crime. Officials repeatedly say that they've taken the worst of the worst, as they say, immigrant criminals off the streets. Does the list submitted by the DOJ contradict that?
It does. Out of the 614 people on the list, 598 do not have a criminal record. That's 97% of the immigrants arrested. So per this document, Juana, most of the people in this sample have not committed a crime. Only 16, or 2.6%, have a criminal history. Of those 16, four of them have criminal convictions. They range from domestic battery to DUI to indecent exposure and kidnapping. One person was labeled a national security risk. Another had a drug arrest. DHS, you know, regularly says that it is taking murderers and rapists off the streets. However, none of the people on this list was convicted or arrested for murder or rape. The list was first reported by the Chicago Tribune. NPR also has access to it. Now, I talked to Michelle Garcia. She's the deputy legal director of the ACLU of Illinois, one of the organizations representing the migrants in the federal consent decree.
You look at this list, and it is very clear that they just did a broad sweep of anybody and not a targeted sweep of people who were here unlawfully and that they knew were likely to flee or were criminals, as they lead you to believe.
A DHS spokesperson did not reply to NPR's specific questions about how this list contradicts the government's narrative that they are targeting, quote, the worst of the worst of criminals. By the way, Juana, the vast majority of the people on this list pose a low or medium safety risk if released, according to the Justice Department.
Now, DHS has said that since Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago launched in September, more than 4,000 undocumented criminal immigrants have been arrested. But the list that you've been talking about, Sergio, it only includes 614 people. So what do we know, if anything, about the rest of those that were arrested there?
We are likely to learn more about that in the coming days. This list includes names of people in detention as of October 22nd. According to the list, some of them have already been deported or to their native countries or voluntarily removed. Now, the federal judge in Illinois overseeing this case, U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Cummings, has extended the consent decree until early next year. This means that more and more undocumented immigrants who have been arrested could be eligible for release. Judge Cummings has also ordered the government to provide the names and threat levels of the remaining approximately 3,200 people who have been arrested since June 11th, and the government has already appealed the judge's ruling.
NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran, thank you.
You're welcome.
As the weather turns cold in much of the north, maybe it's time to jump in an icy river and go for a swim. Or maybe not. Instead, let's just go along with Eliza Dunn, a student at Dartmouth College who took the plunge last winter in the Connecticut River.
I'm at a boat launch just off of Route 5 in Norwich, Vermont. It's late February and it's bitter cold. Alongside three other women, I'm getting ready to go for a swim.
So I came dressed in like a wearable blanket, sweatpants, wool socks and tennis shoes with my bathing suit under.
This is Allie Evans, one of the members of an Upper Valley cold water dipping group called the Brave Souls. The other women here are also buried under layers of clothing. But when it's time to swim, they all strip down to bathing suits. Before I know it, they're wading into the river, pushing away floating blocks of ice.
Did not fall at all.
The timer starts. 3 minutes on the clock. When I learned about the Brave Souls here in the Upper Valley, I knew I needed to join them for a dip.
But in those really cold days, we've had to like kind of break through the ice to be able to get into the water. We just crushed right through it.
This is Amy Green. Amy essentially serves as the main organizer of the Brave Souls, even though she just moved to Norwich over the summer from northern Vermont. And not long after that, she roped in her new friend Kendra, who's also pretty new to the Upper Valley.
Kendra Littner. I live in Hanover, New Hampshire. When I went for the first time, I knew nothing. I didn't know you stay there for 3 minutes, which is insane.
Amy and Kendra have very different takes on what happens next.
When I go in, the instant pain is terrible. Like, what are you doing? I like to just, like, I take in the beauty, and then I'm always just reminding everybody, like, look how beautiful, like, distract yourself. I feel like Amy's always like, oh, turn to the sunset, sunset. She'll be like, look, we're here, and the sun is shining. Like, very calm, relaxing stuff. Makes me want to punch her in the face.
Oh, actually, the face didn't feel that bad.
For this.
Yeah.
Yes, I like to swim. I like getting that.
And then the timer goes off. The Brave Souls have been in the water for a little over 3 minutes.
Yes!
When you get out, like, it's almost like just having like a rush of caffeine or a rush of adrenaline. Like, you're just like, yes. And I feel like just super, I want to say happy. Like, your body just kind of like feels so good. Like, you've done something for yourself.
So how's everyone feeling?
Great. Ooh, excellent. I feel energized and surprisingly not cold yet.
At first, it was that post-dip feeling that kept them coming back to dip. But now, after months of consistent dipping, both Amy and Kendra say it's more than the feeling that keeps them going.
I really think it's about being with other people. The group is, they're nuts. I need nuts. Nuts keeps me going. This is something, I have no idea what it does, but it's definitely brought me closer to people that I, again, said would have never met.
And through it all, here in the Connecticut River, they've forged a sense of home. And not just in a normal way, in a crazy, breathless, shrieking, cursing kind of way. And at the end of every dip, the Brave Souls bundle back up. They crank the heat in their cars, and they promise each other that they'll be back next week.
That story was from the NPR College Podcast Challenge finalist, Eliza Dunn. The 2025 contest is now open for entries.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement. Dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at DalesAutoBodyINC.com. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. The Friends of the Grand Rapids Area Library will hold a holiday book boutique Monday, November 24th from 10 to 6 at the library, featuring books of all kinds, plus puzzles and games. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, special election results keep the DFL in control of Minnesota's Senate. Then, a historic political victory for a St. Paul community. And how Minnesota will recognize Transgender Day of Remembrance. I'm Gracie J. Well, both Minnesota Senate special elections were retained by their parties, preserving the DFL's 34-33 majority. Representative Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager won the District 47 race previously held by Nicole Mitchell, whose seat became vacant after Mitchell's burglary conviction. Hemmingson-Yeager's victory will prompt another special election in the House. The District 29 seat, left open by the passing of Republican Senator Bruce Anderson, stayed in GOP hands with a win by Michael Holmstrom. Next, the city of St. Paul has long been home to one of the country's largest Hmong communities. This year's mayoral election gave that community a historic victory. Zan Holston has the story.
My name is Kalee Herr, and I'm proud to stand before you today as the first Asian and the first woman mayor-elect for the city of St. Paul.
Last week, Democrat State Representative Kalee Herr made history when she became the next mayor of St. Paul. After just a three-month campaign, Herr defeated two-term incumbent Mayor Melvin Carter, the city's first black mayor. She previously worked as policy director for Carter.
This wasn't about running against something. It was about running for our city and the people who make this a great city.
The 52-year-old first won a seat in the Minnesota House of Representatives in 2018. Along with Brooklyn Center's Samantha Vang, the two became the first Hmong women to be elected to the Minnesota House. Since then, she's been a steady presence in the Capitol, organizing DFL support and keeping her caucus united on major votes. At Hmong Village, a bustling indoor marketplace on St. Paul's east side, midday shoppers stop for lunch or groceries. For many here, hers win feels personal.
I was excited, very excited that, you know, someone who kind of represents the Hmong culture got elected to be a mayor.
Yua Yang was there with friends visiting from near Sacramento, California, for whom having a Hmong mayor is a little more common. Steve Lee became the first Hmong mayor in the U.S. in nearby Elk Grove, California in 2017, and Shang Tao was elected mayor of Oakland in 2023. For Yang, it's not just symbolic. It's recognition for a community that's helped shape the city's identity.
Because it's a large community here in St. Paul. So it's good to have somebody to represent the Hmong culture, the Hmong, and, you know, also be an eye-opener for other cultures that we do also exist.
I'm actually really excited for it because she, I believe, will be the first Hmong mayor in St. Paul here. So that's been something that has been very exciting for the Hmong community.
At her restaurant in Hmong Village, La Yang spoke about excitement around her new role. While Yang doesn't live in St. Paul and couldn't vote in the election, she said friends and family were actively involved in campaigning and voting.
There's a candidate that they really strongly believe in her causes and the things that she wants to accomplish here.
On the campaign trail, Herr promised to make St. Paul more business-friendly and to attract investment and expand opportunity. For Yang, that message resonates. But she says what matters most is what Herr represents for younger generations.
And I can't wait to see all the great work that she's going to get done here.
Herr's victory marks a milestone for St. Paul and the Hmong community. What comes next, supporters say, is turning that pride into progress. Herr takes office as St. Paul's next mayor in January, and Governor Tim Walz is expected to call a special election to fill her seat in the House soon. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota will hold a Transgender Day of Remembrance vigil at the State Capitol Rotunda on November 20th. The event honors transgender people whose lives were lost to anti-transgender violence and raises awareness about ongoing violence affecting the community. The observance began in memory of Rita Hester, a transgender woman killed in Massachusetts in 1998. This year's vigil is organized by the state's Inclusive Employee Resource Group for LGBTQIA2S+ employees.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It has been over 4 years now since the last U.S. troop left Afghanistan. But even now, we are still learning new things about the 20-year U.S. presence there. Last week, the Washington Post broke a story about a covert CIA operation that took place in Afghanistan over the course of about a decade. The goal was to degrade the country's opium crop, which points to how U.S. military intervention leads to ripple effects far beyond the battlefield. For more on the details of this operation, we are joined by Washington Post reporter Warren Strobel. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some of the basics. Why was this important for the U.S. to do? Why did people feel like they needed to degrade Afghanistan's poppy crop?
Well, you know, the U.S. got into Afghanistan and the Bush administration thought it would be a quick war, quickly pivoted into a war in Iraq. And then after a couple of years, the U.S. found itself mired in a really deadly conflict and soon came to realize that the opium crop, which was one of Afghanistan's main exports, Scott, was funding the Taliban, funding the insurgency, and also destabilizing government the United States was trying to support. So it was this huge roadblock to any potential success. And there were deep, deep debates about what to do, what was possible, how to solve it.
Can you walk through exactly how this operation worked? What was happening? What was being dropped from planes? How they carried this out?
So this began in the fall of 2004, and it was in the fall because that's when Afghan farmers typically plant their poppy crop. And what happened is that the CIA overflew poppy fields in Helmand and Nangarhar provinces and dropped by the billions of poppy seeds that they had specially developed. These poppy seeds were designed to produce a plant that produced a lot less opium and heroin than normal poppy plants. They were also designed to come up first, so the Afghan farmers would think that they were the best plants, and they were designed to produce a flower that was very vibrant and red, which also made them attractive to the farmers. And the hope was that over time, this strain of poppy plant would dominate in the fields, its seeds would be replanted, and over time you would degrade the potency of the overall poppy crop. Repeats had to be done over a period of years to impact the fields, I guess. Mm-hmm. Roughly 2004 to 2015.
Did it work?
That was the hardest question. I have to say, just without sounding like I'm whining too much, this was a really hard story to get. It took me 9 months for a couple reasons. It was highly classified, involved a presidential finding authorizing CIA covert action, and it was hidden sort of in the mists of the past with different people remembering different pieces or even some people remembering it in different ways. All I can say is that people that I trust, I've known for a long time, suggested to me that it did work, at least for a period of time, in some places. But it was a very expensive program that involved, I won't say massive, but regular airdrops, mm-hmm. Lots of air fuel and security and all that. And as one person put it to me over time, they realized the juice wasn't worth the squeeze.
Yeah. Does any of that, this particular operation that you reported out or other ones like it, do you think that's important context for what we're talking about right now, these much more aggressive, overt, out in the open drone and other kinds of strikes on ships allegedly carrying drugs?
I think in a way it does, and it's not a direct connection, but there is an indirect connection in the sense that I spent 9 months talking to people about the counter-narcotics program in Afghanistan, and despite the perhaps temporary success of the CIA program, it was an abysmal failure. There were arguments about what to do. There were arguments in Washington, arguments between allies, arguments with the government of Afghanistan. There was just simply so much money involved that it didn't work. And I think I have talked to many people with long experience in the war on drugs who believe that Trump's actions in the Caribbean and towards Venezuela ultimately are not going to lead to a major reduction in drug supply. And I think the common denominator here is that neither of these programs is addressing the demand by the U.S. populace for drugs.
I mean, we spent a lot of time thinking about how little
long-term wins the U.S. got, to put it that way, out of a 20-year military presence in Afghanistan. What is the state of the opium trade in Afghanistan today in 2025?
So the Taliban, as we know, retook power in 2021. After profiting from the opium trade for many years, they instituted a ban, which was very effective, at least in the first 2 or 3 years of their renewed rule. I believe the figure is a 91% drop in opium cultivation. But in recent years, particularly in the last year or so, the United Nations reports that it's crept up again. Interestingly, the opium or the poppy farming has moved from the south, where the CIA sort of attacked it back in the day, to more remote areas of the north. And I'm also told by some experts that there's increased poppy farming across the border in Pakistan. So it just, I think it's further illustration of what we were just talking about, how difficult these problems are to control.
Warren Strobel covers U.S. intelligence agencies for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for talking to us about your latest reporting.
Thanks so much for having me.
And a note, the CIA declined to comment on Warren Strobel's story.
You may not even know that the Winter Olympics are just 10 weeks away, but for athletes, now is crunch time. They are battling to secure spots on the U.S. team, and there are super fans following every step on the journey. NPR's Ping Wong met some at the U.S. Curling Olympic Team Trials in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
It's very cold in the Sanford Premier Center, where the floor is a sheet of ice. On the playing field, curlers slide big stones from one end to the other, aiming for the targets, which are concentric circles in red, white, and blue. The loudest fans are some of the youngest.
Hey, how about this? How about if you're in elementary school, let's make some noise!
Several hundred kids on a school field trip cheer as top U.S. curlers fight for a chance to compete in the upcoming Winter Olympics. Bernie Wigand from Huntsville, Alabama, is here to serve as a good luck charm for his team.
I feel that my presence definitely helps, although the skill is definitely rests with the boys.
The boys, meaning Team Schuster, whose captain John Schuster has represented the U.S. at every Winter Olympics since 2006.
I just try to keep a positive attitude, and I have to learn all the cheers.
But Team Schuster's luck runs out. They lose to Team Casper in the finals, a group of 20-somethings who were in elementary school themselves when Schuster made his first Olympics. Bree Dumais and her friends flew in from Arizona.
So Tucson Curling Club, just the 12 of us, having a good time.
They're wearing special hats they bought on Etsy, which mimic the stones used in curling.
So it's gray knitted on the bottom. The top has the handle that the curlers actually release when they are letting the stone go across the ice. So it's that on our head.
In the game, the curling stones actually weigh about 40 pounds each. Cynthia Benning is a super fan from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's ringing her cowbell for good shots. She says curling is strategic, like chess on ice, and it's a lot harder than it looks.
So it takes a lot of balance and coordination, athleticism.
Players follow the stones down the ice, sweeping vigorously to guide them to a precise landing.
They have to go really hard on that broom. It's exhausting just watching them sweep sometimes.
The winning teams now head to the Olympic qualifiers in Canada next month. They'll have to finish in the top two spots to make it to the Olympics in February in Milan Cortina. Ping Huang, NPR News, Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the mid-teens, low 20s. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the low to mid-40s, overnight lows in the mid to upper 20s. And Wednesday,